one, which is a lengthy item for 75 minutes on pinnipeds. So Nate, I'll turn it over to you, sir. Nate et al. You can tell us what they do with all those dead sea lions.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the Commission, Director Susawin. Maybe before we jump into pinnipeds, I just wanted to follow up on a couple budget items. We had staff emailing me on a couple items. First off, thanks for recognizing all the work that we did on the budget proposal. And really, I think the game changer for this year was the formation of the Budget and Policy Advisory Group and all their work going out and talking to others on behalf of the department and supporting having a healthy Fish and Wildlife Agency. There was a question, I believe, by Commissioner McIsaac about wanting to understand what elements of the decision packages were tied to potential tax increases. And right now, it's all general fund, and all that general fund is associated with the tax increases. So there isn't like you get this much general fund, and then here's a decision package that's tied to a tax increase. It's all in the same pot. There isn't any particular item that's insulated better or worse than others. The other question was Commissioner Holzmiller's question about the funding line item for a review of the lower Snake River dams. That money is parked in the department's budget, but it will actually be contracted back to the Governor's Office of Financial Management to actually conduct that review. So, yeah. Okay, so on to the pinniped briefing. Good morning. My name is Nate Pamplin. I'm the Policy Director and joined today by...
I'm Scott Pearson. I'm a research scientist in the wildlife program.
My name is Joe Anderson. I'm a research scientist in the fish program.
I wanted to provide a little bit of context for this presentation this morning. The topic of pinniped management has come up in a variety of policy forums, whether it's been the Puget Sound Chinook Harvest Management Plan or the Governor's Task Force for Southern Resident Killer Whale Recovery or even the Pacific Salmon Treaty. And I also think it's really important when we're talking about predator-prey management and interactions to keep in mind that there's a number of disciplines that kind of come together before you make a decision one way or the other. And that's taking a look at the ecology, making sure that we understand what authorities we'd have or would not have, understanding the logistics and costs, and then factoring in the socio-political elements. As a reminder, this is our third pinniped briefing in the past 5 months. In August, I presented an overview of pinniped biology and talked a little bit about the Chasco paper, which we'll highlight again today, as well as we just introduced some of the elements under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. In November, we took a deeper dive into what's going on in the Columbia River. And for the presentation today, we're not going to be really talking about the Columbia River, although I do want to acknowledge that the U.S. Congress passed a bill here this week that will streamline some of the management efforts in the Columbia for doing removals of sea lions in certain portions of the river. And we'll need to apply for a new permit to be able to utilize that authority. This is a primarily a technical presentation, and I'm so glad to have partnered with Dr. Pearson and Dr. Anderson on this project. They have done a ton of work on this. We're compiling decades worth of work on the fish side as well as on the wildlife side and putting this and packaging this together. Ben Nelson and Steve Jeffries have done a ton of work as well. You can see the number of partners and funding sources there, including National Marine Fisheries Service. Because there's a lot of material today, we're going to try to keep you oriented based on this slide here, and we'll revisit this on the series of questions. And I would maybe ask the chair and others, if there's questions that we can offer clarity on the information on that slide, please let us know. But on as far as we're telling a story, and a lot of the questions I think we'll probably address just on a subsequent slide.
I think we'll just hold off on questions. Yeah.
Um, And so with that, really appreciate the opportunity for the briefing, and we'll turn it over to Dr. Pearson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the Commission. And I just want to briefly again introduce Steve Jeffries, who's behind me somewhere, who's been working on pinnipeds here in the state for nearly 39 years, and for our agency, expert on the species, and has provided a lot of information that we are using today. And I'd also like to recognize Ben Nelson, who's also in the audience. He's a PhD candidate at the University of British Columbia, and helped us with some of the modeling that we'll be talking about today. And they may as well help us with questions. And I just want to emphasize, as we start, that we'll be looking at a pretty simple way of looking at the world today, and we'll be looking at the relationship between Chinook and pinnipeds. And it's important to set the stage that this occurs in a very complex ecosystem, and it's a very complex food web. And when we look at something like pinnipeds, which you can see the seals here, and we're primarily looking at the relationship with this area over here, the juvenile and adult salmonids, it's important to realize that there are factors that are influencing the seals from above, like transient killer whales, and that the seals themselves are influencing a variety of other species below them. They depend much more strongly on some of these other species, like hake, small pelagics, herring, etc. As a result, there's going to be both these positive and negative indirect effects that are only revealed through ecosystem modeling and modeling at a different scale. So I just wanted to set the context with that. And I also wanted to let you know that we have partners that are looking at this sort of ecosystem scale. There's a food web modeling effort that's going on at NOAA right now that we are providing data for, and that's an Atlantis model. Essentially looks at a food web like this and looks at, okay, if I change one thing in this food web, how does it ripple through the rest of that food web? As well as we have partners who are working on specific other areas of this food web. So I just want to I think you really know the problem. Salmon populations today are a fraction of what they historically were, and we would like there to be more. And that has negative effects on all kinds of things, from fishing opportunities to, as we know, species like the southern resident killer whale, which depends heavily on Chinook when it's here in our intermarine waters. And we are seeing this population of killer whales going down over time, and that's particularly in the L-pod. And with that stage set, there are a variety of factors that are limiting the recovery of salmon and of Chinook in particular. And that includes hydropower, includes hatcheries, it includes habitat, disease and parasites, contaminants, competition, and so on. And as I mentioned before, we're working through the Early Marine Survival Project with partners like Long Live the Kings, NOAA, et cetera, the tribes, to look at a variety of these different factors all at the same time. But today we're going to be focusing on just the predation portion. And why might we focus on the predation portion? Well, as Nate introduced previously, the Chasco paper came out, and several papers have come out, and they highlight the importance of pinnipeds to Chinook populations in particular. And it was a Puget Sound buyer, and I should also point out that a couple of us sitting here today are co-authors on this paper, so I should say we. It's a Puget Sound bioenergetics model. It estimates the consumption of Chinook salmon from 1970 to 2015. We modeled the population size, diet, and energetic demands of killer whales, California sea lions, Stellar sea lions, and harbor seals. And based on that work, we found that Chinook consumed by pinnipeds has increased dramatically over time. And that's not really that surprising, considering that pinniped populations have also increased dramatically during that same window of time. I guess what probably alarmed most people was the thought that pinnipeds are consuming more than killer whales in all the fisheries. And so we then took the Chasco model as our starting point and then moved forward from there. And how is the work we're going to present today different from that in, that you already see in Chasco? Well, we're using more recent seal population estimates. In Chasco, the estimates were through 1999. We're using more recent estimates, although there is supplementary material in that paper where they talk about what if the population of seals had declined. We're using a similar modeling approach, a bioenergetics modeling approach. We also express molt consumption as a fraction of the total abundance. And we examine sensitivity to assumptions of marine survival after encountering seals. And we also use, I forgot to mention, new diet information. They use information, we use information in the Chasco et al. Paper from Canada. And then we took that information and spread it throughout the whole Salish Sea. And now we're going to use information from Puget Sound. So let's start with those questions, and I'll walk you through kind of our process using those questions. And so what are the primary pinnipeds in Washington? Where are they located? How many are there? And what are their population trends? And because we're over time, I'm going to skip some of this, and I think Nate covered some of this previously. And because we're really focusing on the harbor seal example, I'm really not going to focus too much on the other two pinnipeds today. It's not that we're ignoring them. We were working on those as well. But today, given our time, we're going to focus primarily on harbor seals. But the three species of pinnipeds in Washington that people are most concerned in terms of their impact on salmonids are these three. And we do have other pinnipeds in Washington, and we're totally ignoring those for now. And some of those actually reproduce in Washington. So I'm going to ignore the California sea lion slide and just point out that its population went up, it stabilized, and actually more recent estimates suggest it may be coming down again a little bit. You kind of expect that with populations that reach carrying capacity. They'll fluctuate after they achieve that. Stellar sea lion, again, I'm going to skip mostly. I just want to emphasize, though, this species appears to be have a growing population, and the population is still appears to be growing today. And then I'll focus on our example that we're going to walk through today, the harbor seal. And it's a year-round resident in our waters. There's one coastal stock and three stocks in the inland marine waters. And so the outer coastal stock that we have, or the outer coastal population we have in Washington, is part of this larger coastal stock that's Oregon and Washington. And we estimate there are about, in that area, around 15,500 animals. And then as you move into the inland marine waters, we have the northern inland water stock. We estimate there are around 17,000 or so animals in that stock. And then as you move down to the Hood Canal stock, there are around 580 or so animals. And then we have the southern Puget Sound stock, where there are around 1,300 animals. And these estimates are based on aerial surveys of haul-out counts. So you fly over and you count them either at the moment, if it's a small haul-out, but if it's a haul-out generally above 20 or 25, we take pictures of it and we enumerate the numbers in that haul-out later. That tells us how many are in the haul-out, but it doesn't tell us how many are in the population. And so we need to move to that population number. And we tend to use, right now, a correction that was developed by Harriet Huber and others in the 1990s. We don't have recent information to update that correction factor that was based on that time, on what proportion of the animals are sitting out on the haul-out and how many of them are actually in the water. And we do these surveys always at the same tidal time, stage in the tide, and that's been consistent over time. And there are reasons why this may not be a good assumption. For example, if they're southern resident killer whales are spending more time and disturbing them more, they may spend less time hauled out. If people are disturbing them more, they may spend less time hauled out. If food resources are better, they may spend more time hauled out. So the variety of factors can affect that. And then the last assumption, our most recent sound-wide estimate, was from 2013. Although we do have more recent estimates from specific areas in the sound, it's the last time we have a sound-wide estimate is from 2013. So is that a good estimate for today? I don't know, but it's what we have. And then when we look at that estimate from 2013 and compare it to the past, we see different dynamics occurring in different parts of the Salish Sea. We see the Puget Sound stock showing that sort of classic logistic growth curve where it went up, and went up dramatically and appears to have stabilized over time. If we look at the Juan de Fuca population appears to be have gone up and may still be increasing. This is also, I should point out, where we have higher predation by southern resident killer whales. And the Hood Canal population may be going down over time. So we have uncertain trends in these, some of these locations, and there appear to be different dynamics occurring in different portions of the Salish Sea. So let's move on to the next question. What do they eat, or what does the harbor seal eat, and how many juvenile Chinook do harbor seals eat? And again, we focus on harbor seals in our example today, and the reason we're doing that is because in the Chasco et al. Paper, what we found was that harbor seals had the largest impact on Chinook, and that impact was primarily through juvenile Chinook consumption, not through adult Chinook consumption. And so we'll go with that. We'll follow through for the rest of today's talk with harbor seals. And just a little bit about methods. We can reconstruct diet of animals in a variety of ways. For pinnipeds here in Washington, we publish papers using stable isotopes, using fatty acids in a variety of different approaches. But one of the methods we've used for a very long time is using these hard parts. And we're using hard parts from poop or feces. So we collect the feces, and we can look at those remaining bones, beaks, otoliths that are in there, and we can reconstruct the diet that way. What's new about this method today is that we are moving into a molecular approach. So we collected a variety of samples. We did this in conjunction with the tribes and then also with our partners at Western Washington University to the north, and funded through Long Live the Kings and a variety of other partners. Collected samples and then analyzed those. And we looked at today, looking at the DNA in the poop. And one thing you can do is you can look at the total DNA in a given feces or your sample, and then what proportion of that is composed of a given species. And that actually correlates well, based on feeding experiments, with the proportion of its actual diet. Then we can use the hard parts in the feces to tell us, was it eating a juvenile or adult salmon? The DNA doesn't tell us that. It's really the hard parts that tell us that. So then we get the ratio, and then we can start to look at how much consumption is occurring of juveniles and adults. So when we did that, we found, not surprisingly, based on a lot of our studies, if you go to different locations in the San Juans, we found that they ate over 70 different species. Down here in South Sound, they found that they're eating over 57 different prey species. One unknown crustacean, 53 species of fish, 3 cephalopods, and 5 salmon species. What we would typically see them eating. No surprises there, and actually really no surprises in sort of the overall general diet. The winter diet is primarily dominated by cotids, species like sculpins, gadids, species like hake, tomcod, and midshipmen, the clupeid, species like herring and anchovy, and then surf perches, squid, and then salmon. And the salmon during the winter is primarily adult salmon. During the spring-summer diet, which is what we're going to focus on for the rest of the talk, and that's when the juveniles are consumed, juvenile salmon, I should say, the spring-summer diet is composed, again, of gadids, species like hake, tomcod, midshipmen, thank you, and also the clupeids, anchovy and herring, surf perches, and the cotids, again, species like sculpins. So a diverse diet, a Catholic diet, what you expect in a general species like the generalist predator like this, highly variable in space and time. We're presenting today estimates from a single year, 2016, from those localities we indicated. We are considering the uncertainty associated with those estimates, and they are considerable. And we found that the juvenile Chinook represents a very small proportion of their total diet. So there's uncertainty with that small proportion. So why do we care about small percents? Well, small percents can become big percents when you scale up. And let me walk you through a single month example. So this is using a single month example. We did this over multiple months, and we use a month as our time step in our model. So a seal consumes about 1 kilogram of fish per day on average. And in this month, the percent of the diet was about 1%. I'm not sure what month this was, but in this month it was about 1%. And the mass of juvenile Chinook consumed, if you take that 1% of that total, it's about 0.02 kilograms per day. And then if you the average mass of a juvenile Chinook is about 0.008 kilograms. And then if you do the math, you figure out, well, they're eating about 2.5 juvenile Chinook per day per seal. And then if we have a population around 19,000 in all the intermarine waters on the U.S. side, that would give us, we can scale it up to around 47,500 Chinook eaten per day. And then if you scale that up across for the whole month, we end up with nearly 1.5 million smolts eaten per month. But I should point out in our model, what's different about our model from the Chasco work is that we are carrying forward that variation on the right column that you see there. Those ranges, those variances are carried forward in a bootstrapping approach, and you end up with a confidence interval associated with that overall estimate. So we know they're eating somewhere between 500,000 and 2.5 million, and that has a really big different implication what number it is. So the distribution looks like this. I want to show it to you, and the reason for showing it to you is that it could be as low as 5.2 million. It could be as high as 26.8 million. A lot of people always grab the central tendency. I encourage you not to, but to think about that range. And we also don't know if the 2016 estimate is representative. And so we, fortunately, based on the funding through Long Live the Kings and other our other partners, we have additional diet information from 2017 and 2018, and those samples are being processed right now. In the next couple months, we'll have more information. So with that, I'm going to hand off the next question over to Joe.
Good morning, Chair and Commissioners. Thanks for this opportunity. My name is Joe Anderson. I work as a research scientist here in the Fish Program for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. I lead a lot of our salmon population monitoring work here in Puget Sound. So I'm going to do my best today to describe the impact of this consumption of smolts that Scott just described in terms of returning adult salmon. Before I get going, I just want to sort of highlight that this is an exercise that's really laden with assumptions and uncertainty. I'm going to do my best to highlight those sources of uncertainty as we proceed here. So by way of background, really just want to emphasize that what we're trying to do here is isolate the marine portion of the life cycle. So there's a whole host of factors that have influenced productivity in freshwater. You can see the sort of bottlenecking on this cartoonish diagram, things like river flow affecting egg-to-fry survival. But the analysis that our team put together really focuses on that marine portion of the life cycle. We're really going to try to isolate that period from smolting or downstream migration to returning as adults to the natal river of origin. So one sort of obvious question is, how does that estimate of smolt consumption compare to our estimates of the total number of smolts that are out there in the marine environment? So actually have pretty good numbers on those values. So put together a pretty simple sort of fractional expression here where we've got our totals for hatchery and naturally produced smolts in the denominator. Data sources for this piece of information, we've got the Regional Mark Information System database. This is a publicly accessible database with our hatchery release information. One point to note here is that the data described here are from the point of release. In some cases, that's tens of miles up the river from the lower end of the river is where we would expect the seals to be encountering the salmon. So there's probably some level of in-river mortality that we're not really accounting for in this simple fraction. So similarly, we have estimates of naturally produced Chinook salmon in Puget Sound. So we have a monitoring network. The department, as well as our tribal co-managers, have rotary screw traps that encounter downstream migrating salmon in most of the large river systems in Puget Sound. We're able to use those catches to estimate abundance. And again, these locations are often upstream of the location where maybe some of these salmon are encountering the seals, but downstream from most of the spawning and rearing areas. So just going to replace that expression with the numbers. The numerator there, those are the same values Scott just ended with, that histogram. The 12.2 million is the central tendency, or to the median of the smolt consumption estimate. Then you've got the 5.2 to the roughly 27 million, 95% credible interval. On the denominator there, I've got the total hatchery release from 2016, about 41.6 million, and an estimate of the total natural abundance for that same outmigration year. So two key points here. Obviously, there's a big numerical difference between the hatchery and the naturally produced fish, about an order of magnitude there, or a 90-10 split. That's pretty typical of what we've seen in our river systems in the last 5 or 10 years or so. The other big difference I'm not showing is in regards to the timing of migration. So those natural fish are migrating over a really protracted period. We see them at our traps when we first install the fishing gear in January. In some systems, they'll move all the way through August, even September. But the sort of January to July period, that six-month window, we'll see fairly continual migration. The hatchery fish, by contrast, predominantly are released in sort of mid-May. So more than half of our hatchery fish tend to be released in about a 2 to 3 week period in sort of mid-May towards the end of the month. So we can take those numbers and simply redraw that same histogram, and rather than expressing it as a number of smolts, now I'm showing you it expressed as a percentage of all the smolts we're estimating to be present in the marine area of Puget Sound. So that range is from about 5% upwards of 60 or even 70%, with a central tendency around 20 to 25%. So a fairly significant fraction of our total estimated smolt abundance. Another real obvious question is how does this estimate of smolt consumption as a percentage compare to what we know about marine survival? And so we typically do that in fisheries biology by calculating what we call a smolt to adult return rate. It's a simple fraction where the denominator is the total number of smolts entering the marine environment from a given group, and the numerator is the number of returning adults. So I pulled together as much information as I could from Puget Sound. So for naturally produced salmon, I looked to our smolt trapping operations that the department monitors in these sort of major river basins in Puget Sound. On the hatchery side, I looked at the coded wire tag data for sort of our primary production facilities in Puget Sound. I really made an effort to try to identify the hatchery programs that numerically are making the biggest contribution to total smolt abundance in Puget Sound. Most of these data are sort of reflecting our estimates of smolt to adult return rate for the last 10 or 15 years or so, depending on the individual population. So here's a histogram providing that comparison. So the histogram on top in blue should look familiar. That's the same one I just showed you a couple slides ago, reflecting the seal consumption. Now, the second and third rows in green and red are my estimates of smolt adult return rate for the naturals in green, for the hatchery fish in red. You can essentially think of those histograms as the survivors in a given release group. So one real sort of important point here is to point out the x-axis here. On the seal consumption, we're going from 0 to 100%. These estimates of the survivors, we're going from 0 to 2%. Most of the estimates of SAR, both for the naturals and the hatchery, are less than 1%. These entirety of these distributions could be squeezed right in here on the left sort of section of that blue histogram. What this means is that we're estimating this consumption of smolts by the harbor seals, a single predator, to be an order of magnitude larger than the estimate of the survival percentage. This tells me that the seals are eating a significant percentage of the smolts when you consider that we've identified a single predator. Okay, so from here, a bit of a transition. I want to talk about sort of salmon marine survival. I'm going to start with some sort of conceptual cartoons to illustrate a few concepts. This is really where our uncertainty starts to significantly increase. So in general, what I'm showing here is a depiction of the marine rearing period with time on the x-axis starting at the point of smoltification and then all the way down to returning as an adult. On the y-axis, I've got the number of salmon. So in general, we have pretty good estimates for our smolt abundances, just talked about the hatchery release data, as well as our smolt trapping operations and our returning adults. What we really want to know is what is the shape of the line that connects these two points. That tells us about the marine survival schedule, the rate of mortality as it proceeds through the marine rearing period. Now, if mortality were constant, you'd see a straight line. That means the rate of fish sort of leaving the population is constant throughout the 2 to 4 years that these animals are spending in salt water. Now, we know from a variety of scientific approaches, sort of a wealth of literature, that that's unlikely to be the case. Almost certainly, there's greater mortality early in marine life than later in marine life. And that's what I'm depicting here. You can sort of see this steep drop-off. The curve then sort of shallows out as you sort of reach the later period of marine residence. Unfortunately, we don't have a really good handle on the sort of precision, the exact shape of that curve. If there's less early marine mortality, more later in life, it might be a little shallower. If there's more early marine mortality early in life, then it'll be a little steeper at the outset. So the uncertainty in that shape of that curve is one of the things that we're wrestling with as we're trying to describe the impact of returning adults in terms of the smolt consumption. So another key concept here is what I'm going to call compensatory mortality. So I've got that same marine survival generalized curve here, sort of a steep drop-off initially. But what I've done is highlight in red that portion of the mortality that is attributable to the seals. We're sort of assuming the seals sort of being positioned in the lower reaches of the river are likely one of the first predators that are getting the opportunity to interact, feed on those salmon. Now, compensatory mortality gets at the idea of what would the marine survival schedule, the rate of mortality, look like if that consumption were somehow reduced or eliminated. And I'm going to present sort of two alternative scenarios here, one of sort of 100% compensation, one of 0% compensation. I'm going to call this plot here sort of the current scenario, and I'm going to contrast this with these two alternative scenarios in which the seal consumption is reduced. So if you look here, hard to see on the screen here, but it's still highlighted in red. The slope is shallower, meaning that the seals in this sort of hypothetical scenario have consumed fewer smolts. Now, under a scenario of no compensation, the mortality schedule later in life is identical. So I'm showing that with a dashed line. At the end of the day, when we're returning as adults, shown here in the open circle, there are more adults returning to the system. So this is a net increase in the overall number of adults. I want to contrast this with a compensatory mortality scenario in which there's 100% compensation. The idea is that the mortality that was incurred by the seals is somehow compensated or replaced by additional mortality experienced later in life. The idea is that if the seals weren't going to consume those smolts, some other predator would. And I show these sort of cartoonish examples, sort of two extremes of a spectrum, 100% compensatory versus no compensation, just to highlight our uncertainty as to the dynamics of the marine environment and the sources of mortality, especially predation, on salmon other than the seals that we've estimated. So, despite that uncertainty, and as promised, I'm going to show some numbers, express this estimated consumption of smolts in terms of returning adults. Just want to highlight the really key assumptions here that I'm making. So first, we've got age-specific survival and maturity schedules of salmon after seal consumption, sort of the shapes of those curves that I was just depicting to you on the previous slides. We're assuming that the seals are consuming the salmon first before any other predators or sources of natural mortality. And then lastly, I'm going to show you sort of different levels of compensation following that seal predation. Okay, so in terms of the survival schedule assumptions, I'm actually going to show two slightly different sets, what I'm calling sort of a lower level of marine survival after the seal consumption and what I'm calling a higher level of seal consumption after survival after the seal consumption. So importantly, what I'm showing here as higher is essentially identical to what Brandon Chasko's paper assumes with respect to the figures showing returning adult salmon. Now, when I look at some simple predictions of what those assumptions would yield given our input of 46.1 million smolts in 2016, the total returning adult abundance and the smolt-to-adult return rate seem a little high. So the smolt-to-adult return rates that I showed you predominantly were centered around 0.5% for the natural fish, and all of the hatchery estimates, or most of them, were less than that 0.5 mark. So I adjusted Brandon Chasko's estimates, his model, slightly down to reflect a prediction of adult abundance, inclusive of seal mortality, and SAR that seem a little more in line with sort of the empirical data that I looked at with respect to Puget Sound. The total terminal run size for the last 5-10 years or so has been on the order of 150,000 to about 275,000 adult Chinook salmon. So that this 232 sort of feels a little more squarely in that range to me than the 464. I show you these tables simply to sort of give you my rationale for ground truthing those survival assumptions. And here's the table showing the adult equivalency. So if you assume no compensatory mortality, here are the numbers. So that in this case, the lower set of assumptions, the 84,000 there, refers to the central tendency of the smolt consumption at 12.2 million. The range here, the 36 to 183, reflects the uncertainty in the smolt consumption estimate, that 5 million to roughly the 27 million or so. Similarly, under the assumption of higher marine survival, here we've got the median, and here we've got the 95% confidence interval of that smolt consumption estimate. On the next line here, I'm going to show you a situation of 50% compensatory mortality. The numbers are cut in half. There's no fancy math here. I took the numbers in that first row. I just divided them by two. The point here, or the assumption here, is that for every two smolts that the seals were eating, one of them would have been eaten by some other predator or died due to some other natural cause. And then lastly, under a situation of 100% compensatory mortality, there's essentially no impact on the adult salmon. All of the smolts that were eaten by the seals, or were estimating to be eaten by the seals, would have been eaten by some other predator. Big range in numbers here, including some sort of eye-popping numbers. I think one important point here is simply comparing the left column to the right column. If you assume a higher level of survival after the sort of seal consumption, you're going to yield a higher number of adults returning. I also sort of am deliberately showing you the extremes of the distribution, zero compensation, 100% compensation. The truth is probably somewhere in the middle in reality, sort of a real-world scenario, but I'm showing you the extremes to sort of highlight the uncertainty, and especially this last row, the 100% compensation, to sort of emphasize the point that, in my opinion, even if the seal consumption were somehow reduced or eliminated, there's no guarantee of a response by the salmon in terms of returning adults. That's sort of my material. So at this point, I'm going to sort of turn it over to Scott and Nate here and sort of carry us forward.
All right. Moving on to our questions. We're getting there. What level of seal removal is needed to achieve meaningful increases in Chinook return rates? So in this exercise, I think it's important to remember, or what's critical to remember, is that sort of this estimate of intermarine water seals is around 19,000. And we just grabbed three arbitrary levels of reduction of juvenile Chinook consumption by seals. We chose a 10, 25, and 50. I could have grabbed anything. And say we want a 10% reduction in total juvenile consumption by seals. How much do we have to reduce that seal population by to achieve that? So you have to go from this 19,000 seals down to a 17,100 or so seals. That means you have to initially remove 1,870 seals from the population, and then you have to remove annually, to keep it at that level, 255 seals, because the population is continually trying to grow after it's been reduced. You brought it down below carrying capacity, it's going to want to get back up there again, assuming carrying capacity doesn't change. The same example here, you want a 25% reduction in the total juvenile Chinook consumption by seals. We have to reduce this number of 19,000 seals down to 14,300. If you subtract this number from this number, that's how many we have to remove, 4,700 seals, and we have to annually remove 530 seals per year to keep it at that level. this relationship's not linear, if you notice, and part of that reason is it depends on where you are in the logistic growth curve. If you bring it further down into that area of the curve where it wants to grow very rapidly, your annual removal rate's going to be higher. If you bring it down into that upper part of that curve where the growth rate is less, you have to remove fewer individuals per year. So what other information would we like to see as we move forward with continuing to work on these kind of questions? We feel that we want to know more about pinniped predation, particularly a better understanding of the window of time when juveniles are consumed. So we, in our modeling work, we looked at consumption between February and July-August window of time. But we don't know exactly when that consumption begins and ends. We want a better understanding of where seals forage on juvenile salmon. So are they doing it everywhere, or are there certain spots where there are these hot spots of consumption, where if you wanted to target management, you might be more effective? And we have ideas on how you might get there. We would love to have additional years of harvest seal population estimates to increase our confidence in carrying capacity. Remember I mentioned that we had continual sampling through around 1999 of the harvest seal population, and then we have the single point sitting out here in 2013. So it creates a lot of uncertainty about where that population is now. So if you fit a logistic model to that, the confidence around that just expands way out, and so we have a lot of uncertainty in that population. What we'd like to have is a few more estimates to help anchor that down. We'd like to have additional years of seal diet information from other locations to understand the temporal and spatial variability in the diet. Unfortunately, we're getting some of that. There's more sampling occurring up in Canada, and then we have additional 2 years worth of data from down here. We'd like to have more information on adult seal consumption, so that winter months, those when the adult salmon are returning, or late summer, fall, winter period. Better diet information for California and Steller sea lions. We have some for California sea lions in terms of using the newer, more modern techniques. We do have diet information using sort of the older frequency of occurrence data from feces. We'd also like to have some more information on salmon survival, a better understanding of smolt migratory survival, especially for hatchery origin out migrants. And we'd like to have a better understanding of the body size of salmon consumed, particularly predation on large resident Chinook, or also known as blackmouth. Because if they are eating the blackmouth during that out-migration window, it has potentially a big effect on our estimates. And we'd like to know, is that true? I would like to have a better understanding of the window of time when juveniles are consumed, something I just mentioned on the predator side. And then we'd like to put all of this in a better ecosystem marine food web context to understand how transient killer whales are affecting the pinniped populations, and we'd like to look at other sources of marine mortality on juvenile salmon, other salmon predators, timing and magnitude of their consumption, and the linkage of seals in those other salmon predators. We know that seals, for example, eat hake. Are the hake also eating salmon? And if they are, could they be having an indirect positive effect through that link? And now I'll move on to the next.
So our final question for this presentation is just, what are the administrative options that are out there to reduce pinniped predation? And the state does not have management authority over marine mammals, so everything that we would do would need to be authorized by the National Marine Fisheries Service. The Marine Mammal Protection Act was adopted in 1972, and the goals of the act are to maintain species or marine mammal stocks at what's called their optimum sustainable population size, and that they're retained as a significant functional element in the ecosystem. The act describes that we need to take depleted stocks of marine mammals and bring them back into the range of that OSP. And the Act has a number of provisions to reduce bycatch. In general, throughout the Act, they're looking, you know, Congress was aiming towards a zero mortality rate. It is the Marine Mammal Protection Act, not the Marine Mammal Conservation Act or the Marine Mammal Management Act. Under the Marine Mammal Protection Act, under Section 101, it establishes the take moratorium, and it says that there shall be a just a moratorium of take, and take is defined similar to how take is captured under ESA. That is, you can't harass, hunt, capture, kill, or attempt to do any of those activities to any marine mammal. Thus, the management options, there's really three pathways. And we talked about this a little bit in August, and I was asked to bring forward a more of a pro-con analysis for your all's understanding. Those three pathways are applying for a waiver of the take moratorium, requesting regulations to allow for a direct take, and then get a permit. So that's the first path. The second is that we can request that management authority is returned to the state, so the way it was pre-Marine Mammal Protection Act. Or lastly, there's an actual pinniped removal authority under Section 120. So let's take each one in turn. Under the first series of pathways, I just acknowledge that in conversations with NIMS and the Marine Mammal Commission, this pathway is very rarely pursued, probably less than 10 times since the passage of the Act. We know that there's an extensive process. It's spelled out in a number of areas under the Marine Mammal Protection Act, but it includes things such as requiring an administrative law judge hearing. NIMS doesn't have an ALJ, so we need to contract with the Coast Guard to do that. There's the issuance of regulations. This would all need to go and evaluated through NEPA. And then there's a consultation with the Marine Mammal Commission. The Act spells out a number of criteria for this pathway to play out, and you can see a lot of components about stock and ecosystem effects and whether or not it's technically feasible, and are we actually consistent with the overall MMPA. Lastly, with this pathway, there is no process timelines. One example is the Macaw tribe submitted for a waiver of the take moratorium in 2005, and that's still being reviewed by NIMS 13 years later. There's not an ability, for instance, if we were to come through all the science review and some of the other steps that we'll talk about, determine that the logistics were possible, it felt feasible, and we submit this, there is no timeline for NIMS to respond. And if it takes 5 years, there's not a way for us to appeal that they've been taking 5 years. It could be indefinite. So just wanted to acknowledge that uncertainty there. Turning to the second avenue would be a request of transferring management authority to the state. So far, no state has had this occur. What we would do is we would request this, and we would enter into an agreement with the Secretary of Commerce over how our marine mammal program would be consistent with the Marine Mammal Protection Act. So this would require pretty substantial investment by the state. We may need to adopt some work with the legislature to get new state statutes. It will require new rules and regulations through the Fish and Wildlife Commission, and we need to have a program robust enough that we're carrying out all aspects of the MMPA for the species or stocks that are transferred to our management authority. Further, the only stocks that can be transferred are stocks that are at OSP. And I'll connect here in just a couple slides. We need to work with the Marine Mammal Commission and the Pacific Fisheries Management Council. Another aspect of this is Section 109 is exempt from NEPA. But SEPA would likely apply, and there's no process timelines to actually do the transfer. The last pathway is one we're more familiar with. This is the current letter of authorization that we have from NIMS to do some California sea lion removals at Bonneville Dam. And we just think about, let's apply that those expectations to other areas, for instance, in the Puget Sound or the Outer Coast. This provision allows the intentional lethal taking of pinnipeds that are having a negative impact on listed salmonids. We need a permit that's very specific for number of animals removed and the location and timing. The stocks can't be identified as depleted. There is the establishment of a pinniped fishery interaction task force to review the state's application. It does need to go through NEPA. And this is the hard part here, I think, with this particular pathway, is the animals need to be individually identifiable. And so the way that works with Bonneville right now is there's observers on Bonneville Dam that are watching animals that we have caught and branded and released, and within probably 300-400 yards of the dam face, we're actually able to see, oh, it was C260 that just ate that sturgeon. So we don't have that type of scenario really anywhere else. So it would be, a really difficult challenge to meet the requirements of this particular pathway because of being able to individually identify animals. And in particular, thinking about for harbor seals, where they're eating smolts, and we're not going to see that predation event. So other considerations just in general across the board. This would be a very highly contentious proposal. Under the Marine Mammal Protection Act, it is it's an extensive process. It's untested, and it's really complicated. It's rarely pursued. There's ripe opportunities for legal challenges, and really it's an uncertain outcome of whether or not we'd actually obtain approvals. We also would likely face a scenario where NMFS does not have the resources to process the application. And so is that something that we would do, where we would actually try to help them secure federal funding to process the application? A similar kind of situation in my mind is what happened with the hatchery genetic management plans, where we submitted a number of those over years and NMFS did not have the personnel to evaluate them. And that certainly has turned around here more recently. And then certainly in part of all of this under the Marine Mammal Protection Act, it talks about doing management under this ecosystem effects. And as my co-presenters identified, there's a lot of data uncertainty that I think would make this a challenging evaluation. One of the things that which Scott showed was the potential removals to get a benefit, but we really need to look at management under what would be allowed under the Marine Mammal Protection Act, and the MMPA defines something called the potential biological removal. This is the maximum number of animals that can be removed associated with human-caused mortality, and it's a simple function of three components. What's the minimum population size? What's the growth rate of that stock? And then penalize that by a half. And then I include another penalty, essentially, as a recovery factor between a tenth of or 10% or 100%. So, for instance, if you had a depleted marine mammal stock like North Pacific right whales, you would take the minimum population size, you would look at their growth rate, and you'd apply a correction factor of 0.1, and that would be the number of whales that could be removed and as far as entangled in fisheries. So that's how PBR is calculated. So let's take a look at what PBR is for our four harbor seal stocks. Well, the marine mammal stock assessment reports haven't been, while they get published, they have not updated and determined whether or not harbor seals are at OSP, that's the optimum sustainable population size, and therefore we also don't have a potential biological removal. So that would be one of the main steps that we would do. We would need to have NMFS do that determination before we could apply and seek reductions that are consistent with a known PBR. So if we were to, we know how to calculate PBR. If we made the assumption that harbor seal stocks are at OSP and we were to calculate this removal level and we were removing up to the potential biological removal, what would be the potential increase in the number of adult Chinook that would occur? And we calculated this using three different compensatory mortality rates. This is bringing in the work that Joe described. And I just summarize, for instance, for three of the Washington inland water stocks. That's the inset there of the inland total. If you have factored in a 25% compensatory mortality rate, it would require that you would be removing up to 1,300 harbor seals that would potentially yield an additional 4,600 Chinook. Now, probably about 10 to 1 is wild versus native, and so, you know, it kind of gets to that next step at this level anyway. You know, it begs the question, is it worth pursuing further? And when we think about that's the kind of more at a population level, it still leaves that uncertainty because we know looking at interactions and stock sizes, boy, just in certain areas, handfuls of adult Chinook returning to streams could make a difference in terms of how fisheries are conducted. In other instances, Puget Sound wide, you probably wouldn't notice the additional 5,000 Chinook. It would be lost in the noise. The governor's task force on killer whales had a couple recommendations on pinnipeds. I just called out recommendation number 12 as it relates to Puget Sound and Outer Coast. They recommended that we conduct a pilot project for removing or altering artificial haul-out sites near areas where we would have concern about outmigration of smolts. They encouraged us to take the work that we've compiled and presented here, bring those analyses, incorporate some of the additional diet data, incorporate more and more recent harbor seal estimates, et cetera, and then work with, for instance, the Washington Academy of Sciences and go through an independent science panel to review this work. We do need to engage NOAA, as I mentioned earlier, to actually determine the optimum sustainable population size for harbor seals from an administrative perspective. The recommendation called for a convening of a co-management panel to look at the science review, and then what are those next steps? In particular, what of those three options, what might be the most the best path forward, if any? And then finally, to provide funding for these recommendations. In the budget that was released yesterday for this recommendation to the department, there's $1.2 million incorporated for us to be able to do this work. And so we'll see how that plays out with the legislature. Shifting now to a little bit of the social aspects of pinniped management, just wanted to share with you the summary of two public comment periods that the task force had around the concept of pinniped predation. About a quarter of folks that responded said they supported lethal removal, but then there's a variety of other concerns that were identified, and you can see those listed here. So just to summarize our presentation, it's really important to consider those biological, administrative, we didn't even talk about the logistical side and the social aspects of this contentious issue. We know it's a complex food web, and we've just isolated one strand, one segment of that food web for the presentation today. While harbor seals are generalist, we do know that collectively they consume a significant number of Chinook smolts. And our ability to actually reduce pinniped predation impacts and having those saved fish come back and return as adult Chinook is uncertain. We know that the MMPA administrative options are very limited and they're very complex. We do think it's worth pursuing the further scientific collaboration that was proposed in the governor's task force, exploring where we can mitigate pinniped predation, in particular in those hotspot areas, maybe those estuaries of concern. And we also need to consider California sea lion and Steller sea lion and harbor seal predation on adult Chinook, and we need to do some further work on the pilot program for the artificial haul out and see if we can adjust behavior there. And so with that, we're happy to take any questions.
Thanks, Nate. Boy, that was a lot. So we have 14 minutes, so we're going to limit our questions. This could go on, but we have to stick to the schedule because we have to reconvene at 1. So we'll start, Commissioner Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to first start by thanking all of you folks. I'm sort of frazzled trying to absorb all of it, to be candid with you. I have two. One question that you might be able to answer now, and one maybe for a future date. The consumption of adult salmon, adult Chinook, by harbor seals, I guess when I say that I'm talking age 3 and up, which I've seen quite a lot of up in the northern part of our state. That's the first question. The other question you might want to take back for another time and place would be your potential knowledge now and into the future about the predation on juvenile Chinook by mergansers and cormorants.
So getting your first question, that is our sort of one of our next steps. We have samples from the winter, so the fall winter time or late summer fall winter time when the adults are returning, and we'll be doing just what you asked. Okay. To estimate that adult consumption and get that into percents. We do have other data from the past, but that's frequency of occurrence in a feces, and it's a really different that information than the percent of the diet that is composed of a given species. It just tells us how frequently it occurs in a feces. It doesn't tell us what percent of its diet is composed of a certain salmon species. So we do have past data, and particularly if we can do a crosswalk between the modern technique and the old technique, we might be able to even use some of the old data as well. But yes, we do want to answer that question.
Okay.
There's currently no plans that I am aware of getting at the predation by birds at this point or other predators, harbor porpoise, et cetera.
It's, I live on the Skagit River, been there my entire life. Significant increases in cormorants and mergansers for another time.
And just to follow up on that, as I've mentioned before, cormorant removal has been successful in other parts of the country. And there has been rebound in fish stocks. So. Yes, Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, and I won't end up asking a question here. I don't think, because in light of time, I don't think we can do that. Maybe I'll just offer a couple of reactions, and perhaps at some future time, I've got quite a list of things here that that are very interesting. So these modeling exercises are very interesting. At the beginning, you mentioned use of the Atlantis model, and so I think some of those ecosystem what-if games are very useful to do. Your overall conclusion here is obviously dependent upon all of those assumptions, and a couple of them caught my eye. The 1% of the diet being salmon, and you mention it later, we need to understand more about that. During the months of May, when all of these hatchery fish and probably most of the natural fish are coming out, and if seals are in these river mouth areas, one would have to think that the diet percentage is much higher than that. If you blend that from January to August and end up at 1%, you know, I don't know that that's the right way to figure it out. You had so much per day, so much per month, and if you extrapolated that by 6 months or 12 months, it wasn't quite clear. But, you know, on the Columbia River, there's some examples of sea lions sitting right at the outflows of hatcheries. And the commissioners all saw a video of sea lions involved in a herring purse seine fishery where they were inside the pursed net. And while I don't know that that's what happens at the mouth of the Skagit River or the mouth of the Nisqually River or anywhere else like that, you would think that during those critical months, if it's more than 1% in the diet, that could make a big difference. And that seems to be the most critical time. It's hard to imagine these seals chasing down a 10-pound black mouth. It's easy to imagine them sitting at a river mouth where natural smolts are looking around trying to figure out how to adjust their whole physiology to salt water, and hatchery fish who've never seen a predator probably swim right into their mouth. You know, that's kind of a consideration. The 0.5% and 1% are pretty critical statistics there in terms of survival. And your seal population graphs go back to the 70s, but the years you use to come up with adult equivalent rates are recent years when there's already a lot of seals that are already eating a lot of smolts. So there could be some confounding of that, and maybe if those percentages were higher to reflect the pristine condition, you'd have different conclusions. I would love to ask a question about hake, because I know there's a whole bunch of them out in the ocean. I don't know how many there are in Puget Sound. And how much of a factor that is in all this, but I'm not going to ask any questions because we don't have time. Again, I'd just love to sit down with you guys later on some of the science stuff. On the management implications at the very end, it almost seems like it's absolutely hopeless to do anything. if the Marine Mammal Protection Act has that kind of ball and chain around everybody's legs that you cannot do anything other than the recent passage on the Columbia, and I'm not aware that the new bill loosens anything up for Puget Sound or not, then it's not even worth doing any science on this. If it's really that bad that you can't do anything, then why even do the science? And so I'm not in that hopeless category that nothing can be done. And dissuasion from artificial haulouts in some people's minds might be harassment. You probably can't even do that if you listen to some people. But I think that if we engage the National Marine Fisheries Service about dissuasion behavior for seals in river mouth areas in April and May and June, whether that be spooking them around with a killer whale, the transient killer whale doll, or who knows what, I would hope that something can be done. And if that is true, then the science then becomes more important, and that's why it's good to keep the exercise going.
Down here. Yes.
Again, we don't have time to answer this question, but Nate, you've known that for a couple of years. One of the things that I've been interested in is busting the ball and chain that that Commissioner McIsaac discussed, which doesn't have to be directly translated in going out and killing a bunch of pinnipeds. But I would like to at some point talk to you or maybe have you explain again to the commission why the idea of Washington taking management over this population is off the table. Aside from the fact that no state's done it and it takes forever to get the approval, I get that. But what I don't understand is if there's any policy or political or procedural reasons why we shouldn't consider that opportunity, more because I trust us and you guys than a huge federal bureaucracy. So that's my question, but it's not to be answered today, I think, unless you want to give it a shot.
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Baker, and also to Commissioner McIsaac's point, I hope I didn't give the impression that the pathways are completely hopeless. I just wanted to acknowledge that they're very complex, and it's something where we would want to make sure all of our I's are dotted, T's are crossed, lowercase j's are dotted. It's going to be incredibly scrutinized, and it does have an uncertain outcome. But I think if we show that there's hotspot areas after we kind of account for the ecology and we think that there is spots where we need to remove some pinnipeds in a, probably a pretty limited basis to provide some relief, I would hope that we would consider that from an administrative perspective. As far as the return to state management, it was just trying to acknowledge that NMFS and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the two agencies that have to carry out the MMPA, they spend a lot of time evaluating take. And so if it were transferred to the state, for instance, if a port needed to conduct a new pier and do some more pile driving, we would have to evaluate whether or not that is consistent with the MMPA. So there's just a lot of burden. It's not just doing the predation management that we've described here. It's all those other elements that, quite frankly, for recovered pinniped stocks is a lot of work with very low conservation benefit. And so I just would want us to be eyes wide open of what that would require to establish a program to review a bunch of take permits that I'm not really worried about the harbor seal population.
Commissioner Keogh, you can have the last word.
Yeah, thank you. And no question, but just a comment. And if you could just go to slide 62, Nate, I think that was your kind of wrap up in terms of potential savings or increase in the number of adult Chinook returning. Is it slide 62? I'm looking here.
Our numbers are slightly off because we
so
had
it's
some
the
animation.
So it's the potential
there.
Increase in the number of adult Chinook if harbor seals right. were removed at PBR level.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That one. Yeah, so that I think was your kind of sum up. It's like, you know, and I obviously we've got some wide confidence intervals. Kind of curious as to why those are. Maybe that's a kind of a discussion you can follow up. And if there's a way to perhaps narrow those confidence intervals in terms of increased sample size or whatever. But I guess my point is that, yeah, these numbers look small, and I assume they're an annual, these are annual increases, right? So, but, you know, in the world, the fish management world that many of us live in terms of, you know, we're literally, particularly with recreational fisheries in Puget Sound, you're looking for savings of a fish, two fish, three fish, in terms of whether or not, for example, there's a coho opportunity in CQ. I mean, that is a big deal, and I know part of the exercise maybe is this going to make a big dent in terms of increase of prey for orcas. That's beyond my level of expertise, but I do, and I can tell you, and folks in this room, our fish managers know very, very much that a savings of just a few Chinook, wild Chinook, are huge in terms of opportunities. So just wanted to make that comment.
Commissioner Farmer can have the last word.
Yeah, well, I'll try to keep my words short, and then I've got, a very quick question. Thank you for the presentation. And I guess I don't have quite the response that I heard out of you, Commissioner McIsaac, in terms of, wow, this is sort of overwhelmingly pessimistic in terms of what can we do. I was really pleased with the fact that you really emphasized there are a lot of assumptions that go into the modeling, and but to me that's opportunity, and it's a reason to keep doing the science. Commissioner Kehoe brings up the confidence intervals. Let's get those a little bit narrower. The more data we collect, the better the data that we have is going to be. So I actually saw this as a lot of opportunity and appreciated that you really did emphasize the uncertainty in this really complex and hot question. Quick question, what is the optimum sustainable population? What is it, what does that mean? Is it carrying capacity or...
So, Mr. Chair, Commissioner Thorburn, optimum sustainable population size is essentially, if you look at the logistic growth curve, if you look at the inflection point up to carrying capacity, that's the range. So that upper half.
So it's a range. Okay.
Yep. So if you took half of carrying capacity up to carrying capacity, is let's consider OSP.
Okay. So
and yeah, we've got, there's the slide there. So here it's. The inflection point here is reflected under this maximum net productivity level. So the highest growth rate that Scott mentioned on the growth curve, it's from that spot up to where the population plateaus at K.
So it just really emphasizes we need to keep doing the census and get a handle on that. Yeah. Okay.
Very good. Well, thanks, guys. That was, again, very, very informative, and we'll look forward to it. And it is 12 o'clock right on the dot.